Welcome back. You're watching Stockwatch with me, Julieta Talebi. And tackling your questions in studio this evening are Gary Boyson from Rand Swiss and Rikus Combrink from Capicraft. So please do send those questions through to us. You can SMS us 41392. You can email stockwatch@bdtv.co.za or you can tweet us at BusinessDayTV using the hashtag Stockwatch. Gary, Rikus, nice to see you both this evening. Rikus, Wall Street opened at a record. It's hit an intraday record. So clearly the takeout from the G20 summit is that there will be a renegotiation of trade talks between USA and China, and we're back off to the races.
I think at least what we can say for certain, well, not completely for certain, but is that there won't be another tariff hit for the next few months at least. You know, the can's being kicked down the road. I don't think there will be any immediate resolutions on the trade front over the next few months. If there is any deal, it will be a contingent deal or one that will save face for other, you know, side of, or for both of them. Maybe Trump will look good for having a half-baked deal going into the election next year. I don't know, but I think what we saw in the last year, and it has been coming some time, is that we've got something brewing that's typically going to last decades. Not years, decades. And this is not a cold war, but a trade standoff. Not just a trade standoff, but the geopolitical risks are changing. And once you enter what they call a Thucydides trap, so a Greek philosopher that coined it. The guy's name was Thucydides.
Yeah.
And when incumbent power is met by a newcomer, most of the times, it ends in some kind of rivalry that is destructive for both of them. Okay, so it's a bit of, yeah, and there's a lot of psychology behind that and game theory, etc. But we're entering that at the moment, where the incumbent, the US, is seeing this rising threats from China,
yeah.
And it's a geopolitical game. So as you know, as analysts in the market, we should take notice of this. Secondly, over the last 30 years, well, actually, since the end of the Second World War, globalization has been on the increase. Liberalization of markets all over the world. More and more bigger markets have entered this world market. China, the latest being, I think, 2001, being brought under WTO. And, you know, we've had this massive globalization drive. I think we know that is plateauing at the moment and might see some headwinds, even though all the leaders of the G20 has said we are committed to free trade. The geopolitical risks at the moment speaks otherwise,
yeah.
Over the longer term.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Time magazine cover is of Xi and the new dynasty under, is this going to be the world's most powerful man? I mean, Gary, we look at markets daily, but Rikus does make a good point that you've got to think of this possibly in terms of the next couple of decades as these tectonic plates shift in global superpower land.
Yes,
I don't know how you trade that. I'm not quite sure where the question was in that.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. You've got to kind of understand where the overall forces are driving and how the trends are changing. And we're seeing, you know, a total change of the world order at the moment. And it's not just because of the geopolitical forces. Mm. It's technologically driven,
sure.
As well.
And
but I was just thinking, like, Xi, is he not the most powerful? Who are you putting against him as the most powerful?
Well, I would say the United States still is the world superpower.
Yes, but who in Donald Trump in the United States is the most powerful? Xi, you know, there's a change to the Chinese constitution that his thoughts are law. Like Donald Trump,
he's leader for life.
Yeah, leader for life. I mean, Donald Trump is
supreme leader for life.
Is taken down by a porn star. China,
not exactly. And he's clearly grooming old Ivanka to take over. If you consider the way she was muscling in on the sidelines.
I think it's a tight race, though. I would probably go Xi as the most powerful person in the world at the moment.
Fair enough. We're sort of veering off the topic and off the day's events.
Yes.
And we did have a pretty good start to the week. U.S. markets are pretty strong.
It's the euphoria.
It's the euphoria. Mm. But the one sector, or I suppose the shares that have now been on the back foot today as a result of other assets rallying, are the platinum and gold stocks, so the precious metal shares, which until now have had an extraordinary run. And there are lots of questions tonight asking whether or not you guys would still recommend buying either gold or platinum producers on a pullback. And if so, if we haven't missed the boat, who would be the strongest companies that you could recommend in this sector?
Yeah, so I don't know if we were recommending gold into that, but Looking at the gold miners, I think that one of the stronger gold miners on our market is Anglo Gold. I mean, they've done a lot to delever their balance sheets, and the reason that you're buying a gold mine is to get that the effect of the operating leverage. So as the gold price goes up, their fixed cost base stays where it is, and suddenly you get this massive increase in profits. Like, unfortunately, you're always going to be they're price takers. They're always going to be buffeted by global gold prices. So if we see gold prices falling now, this for me would be a time that if you have the facility is probably to go short gold. Like we've had a pretty significant run up. If you do see a settling down of these, the tensions around the US-China trade war, you should see gold coming back. On the flip side, though, we haven't seen the pricing of the Fed futures moving at all post G20, which is interesting because if interest rates are still set to fall in the US, that does still make gold a relatively more attractive lower risk asset. But I certainly think it's always difficult when you're not talking specific time frames. I would say very short term, it's time for a little bit of risk on. I think you're going to see gold miners pulling back. Certainly, I think if you're a short term trader, you should be short gold miners at this stage. Mm. There's a long way down for the likes of Anglo Gold, Goldfields. If you've got kind of looking for an entry point, I would give it a couple of weeks. See how these things fluctuate. Mm. Longer term, yes, maybe higher unless you get a change in the stance from the Fed.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to denigrate ourselves, but I had commissioned a story on gold stocks and the gold price for the Financial Mail this week, and I sort of wonder if that means that this is the contrarian sell indicator.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because, this was a bit of a sleeper story. It was a surprise. Mm. All of a sudden, gold shares were up 50%. Mm. Then, Goldfields almost doubled in the space of 3 weeks.
Too much too soon. And but longer term, one must realize one thing. In the 90s, central banks were net sellers of gold by about $500 million a year. Now they're net buyers of gold by about the same amount per year. China is trying to accumulate gold. They want to be the next reserve currency, etc. They're trying to get gold back. Nowhere near that. But as the bigger nations accumulate more debt, one would think that the only alternative currency out there, if cryptocurrency doesn't make any some kind of mainstream entry onto the scene, is the currency that's always been there, and that's gold. So I think entry point, if you're looking for one, on the platinum side is Northam. I think it's a quality miner. They're testing out some new technology together with Master Drill, which might be a game changer for the industry if it works. It's solid management, solid outfit, good mines. Locally, there's only one pure play stock gold miner left on the JSE, basically. All of the others have got operations all over the world. The only one left is Pan Africa. They've had a restructuring in the last year. See, costs per ounce will come down over the next few reporting period. So I think there's an operational story there that might play in your favor while you wait for the gold price to move again. That would be my preferred play.
Okay, so your longer term options, Northam and Pan African. Mm. Gary, so even though you might be short some of the gold producers now, what about the platinum or the palladium stocks? Do you also, because they've also
If you go back and look at gold miners historically as well, it's they're few and far between that produce results like an industrial. Generally, they are hedge type stocks. They're speculator type stocks. You buy and sell gold miners. It's kind of the boom and bust. You expect this kind of volatility. You're talking about suddenly, it caught everyone unawares. But that's exactly how gold miners trade. If I had to pick one that I was going to hold in a portfolio longer term, when I say longer term, 3 to 5, maybe 10 years, I like the look of Sibanye at these levels. I think you get a bit of gold and a little bit of platinum. I think after the Lonmin transaction, they've got a great asset there that I think they're going to take out of the kind of the media spotlight, and they're going to do very well out of that. They've obviously got it's diversified operations across the globe as well. That transaction has gone through. Neil Froneman has proven that he's a very able operator. Also, if we do see higher PGM prices and higher gold prices, that's very, very good for Sibanye, because they're going to pay down that debt, which has really got the market concerned, a lot quicker. If they pay that down a lot quicker, then I think you're going to see a little bit more excitement around the ordinary stock as well, ordinary shares.
Yeah. Okay. What about if you're looking for yield, which a lot of people are, especially if you consider what's happening with interest rates globally, what's the potential for a good yield? And I'm buying Coronation at the current price. Would Coronation be?
Well, it's always a danger to buy common equity for yield. You know, normally you fall into
why? Because, I mean,
in general, well, if there's a strong correlation. If you go to a dividend yield above 5%, it's typically because the dividend is in danger. So there's a very strong correlation between a falling dividend and a high dividend yield.
Okay.
So you would like to look for a safe dividend, but not reach for yield, you know, into the high single digits. Normally, that's a good indication that you're reaching too far.
Is Coronation not that company, though? I mean, is the high dividend yield not more of a reflection of the price of Coronation rather than the potential that its dividend
might to a certain extent, but it's also a value trap. So you might get, what's the dividend yield, about almost 8%, I think. So that high, yeah. So the problem is, it's not like a normal company that uses their funds and reinvests it, and you can get growth from that reinvestment over time. They have to market, and that's expensed mostly to the income statement. Most of their IP is in their personnel costs. It's also through the income statement. So they don't, you know, reinvest like a traditional business. So it's difficult to see where the growth is going to come from if they're not going to raise AUM. And I don't see them raising a lot of AUM. Structurally, in the SA investment industry also, we haven't seen a large shift away from active to passive, and the resulting squeeze on margins for the active players like we've seen offshore. So that might still happen, yeah. And so I'll be careful buying into these. But at these levels, there's a decent margin of safety, but it might be a value trap.
Yeah. Gary, your thoughts there? Or if you were looking for some high-yielding assets, which is what everyone is looking for, good-quality-yielding assets.
Well, I don't know if high-yielding is what everyone's looking for. So, I mean, if you look at yield in terms of you want it to generate income for you, from a tax point of view, you're going to generate income, which a lot of people don't want to generate income. They want to generate capital gains. So, you know, I mean, that's the big reason that a lot of the U.S. stocks have shifted away from paying a dividend and, well, not a dividend, but, you know, kind
and
of creating.
And buy back instead their
shares. Yeah, and they buy back shares instead, so they create the capital gain. I mean, if you're looking at kind of the quasi-yield products, I like the idea of, okay, I know this is stock watch and we're talking stocks, but, you know, other than the kind of the income concern, I think South African bonds are looking very, very good. I think, you know, the equity upside to South African companies at this stage is very constrained. We're in a very difficult market. But at the same time, if you look at our real interest rates compared to overseas, if you look at the risk premium on some of our corporate bonds, I think you're getting a lot of yield for, you know, in risk-weighted terms. I think they're looking pretty attractive. But then again, we're not talking about buying ordinary stock there.
Would you get caught up in if we fall out of the, if Moody downgrades our rating, and if you had been buying our local bonds on the basis that they offer attractive yields, would you then rue the day?
Not necessarily. So if you look what happened with Brazil when that exact event happened, you actually saw a contraction instead. So you saw it go the other way. You saw their currency actually strengthening on a downgrade as well. So yes, there is the argument that, you know, once we drop out of the index, there's no physical way that the market can price this in because of the scale of the move. But at the same time, if you look at our credit default swaps as well, you know, we're sitting well in junk territory already. So the market is pricing a lot of our debt as junk debt, whereas we're not necessarily, I still don't understand why Moody's has this on investment grade, to be honest. Like, you know, if you look at all other metrics, you look at how the market is pricing South Africa, we are sub-investment grade. It's just one ratings agency that happens to have an investment grade stamp on us.
Yeah.
So what you need to look is beyond whatever Moody's might or might not do. You know, is this going to continue forever? You know, the trajectory that we've been on the last 10 years, is it going to be the same the next 10 years? Then yes, then you don't want to own SA government bonds because then we're heading for a fiscal cliff. Now, our deficit is approaching 5% of GDP, and if we don't grow the economy by nearly the same amount or decrease the deficit, then sooner or later we will run into a problem, a big one.
Yeah.
But before we do that, there is a few strings that government will pull. One is your pension, and, you know, by adjusting Reg 28. And that is, you know, if we don't get our house in order or don't get any decent economic growth, I think that is the next step, unfortunately.
Yeah, and there's been some very interesting research on, I think it was also South Africa in the 50s, 60s and 70s when they had prescribed assets, just how poorly you did, whereas if you'd just been free to invest
80s,
in equity markets, 80s,
Or free to invest offshore.
Yeah. We'll leave it there for the moment. If you'd like to take questions, please do SMS us, email us or tweet us, and we'll be back in a bit. Welcome back. Let's have a look at what's happening to U.S. markets, having had a very good start to the week. The S&P up 0.5%, the Nasdaq up 0.8%, and the Dow Jones trading just 0.2% higher. Across the Atlantic, you have the FTSE 100 gaining almost 1% today, the CAC 40 up 0.5%, and the DAX also trading 1% to the good. Perhaps one of the features keeping the Dow relatively subdued is the oil price, which hasn't moved today, and also there is going to be a bit of a, well, there has been a decision by the OPEC producers to restrict supply, and I thought that would be supportive of the oil price, but it hasn't had much impact at all. Gary,
It wasn't really just the OPEC. There was a lot of complaints about how it was restricted as well, because it wasn't just the OPEC producers. It was Saudi Arabia and Russia.
And Iran is not
an OPEC member, and Iran is now saying that there could be a collapse of the cartel. But there's a lot of, research going back that actually says that the only reason that the OPEC cartel has lasted as long as it has, compared to sugar cartels from the 50s and tin cartels, is because Saudi Arabia is such a dominant player that they can set policy. You don't face the usual, what we were talking about earlier, the game theory. You don't face that kind of prisoner's dilemma, because you have Saudi Arabia kind of dictating how this cartel is going to work, which makes it more of a monopoly than a cartel, actually. But certainly, I think it was more than priced in. That's why we're not seeing a move on the oil prices.
And they're getting less relevant by the day. You know, U.S. Energy production has shot through the roof the last decade, and it's still increasing. And with the technological advances in shale gas extraction, you know, I don't see that stopping in the near term.
Yeah.
And I think that's maybe one of the better news stories out there in the global economy the last few years, is that we've depressed the price of energy because the U.S., you know, had these shale discoveries. They released, all these exploration rights, and the technological advances enabled them to extract it at cost-efficient prices. I think that's one of the better stories, actually, in the last decade.
Well, certainly is saving our bacon. I think they'd be writing if the oil price was much higher than it is at the moment, given where the rand is. We were talking about coronation. The particular viewer was buying coronation in the search for yield. Now, this is a slightly sort of a side question, and it's quite a lengthy one, but I'm just kind of trying to mention bits of it, saying, I'd like to express my concern about our stock market. I've been watching this program now for many years, and I have to say that our companies seem to be everything but good governance, integrity, honesty, etc. And then he says, how can one actually make money for one's pension when these big companies are riddled with issues so often? But he goes on to say, we pay the financial advisors, and they in turn put our monies into the asset managers' funds, and they take commissions, so they never lose out. Win or lose, they get paid. We, the poor investor, always lose out and get told, hang in, times will improve. Brackets, capital letters, who are they kidding? So I feel that asset managers' fees should be linked to performance, and that way they would take more care as to with whom they invest our money. I mean, that's not a stock-specific question, but do you think it's a valid argument?
Some of it's definitely valid. So I would say that our larger asset managers have, and financial service companies in general, have a vested interest to keep you invested in the local market. And I think to a large extent they've downplayed the need to invest offshore. Your typical UK pension fund invests more than 60% outside the UK. So, you know, if a first world country like that invests more than 60% of their funds offshore, who are we to restrict ourselves to 35%
without Regulation 28.
Exactly, the prudential limits. And, you know, the same advice is being given to guys with discretionary capital. I think that's changing at the moment. But if you in your pension fund, if that's the better part of your capital is only 35% exposed offshore, I think your discretionary capital should be 50% plus to make up for the difference. And I think, you know, the larger players in the industry might be a bit guilty of that, downplaying the need for that, and maybe always being supportive or constructive of a good story, a good SA story, when it's not really apparent to most of us.
It's like the emperor's got no clothes.
Yeah,
absolutely. So, which would then also maybe be the case against investing in companies like Coronation or maybe Peregrine or any asset manager or Old Mutual for that matter, or Sanlam or Momentum or Liberty. I mean, would you include all those shares and companies that you might avoid?
I think the viewer's concern is valid. Let's put it that way. but one thing that we've got to remember as well is that companies, one of the reasons that you invest in a stock, invest in a company, is that it has a management team that can adapt to changing circumstances as well. So, you know, sure, a big asset manager that is managing half a trillion in assets, it's very difficult for them to shift tack as a group overall overnight. You can't suddenly say, well, investors, you know, things have changed on the ground in South Africa. We actually want to take all your funds offshore. I mean, there are mandates in place. It's an incredibly difficult thing to switch a book offshore. So it's, maybe they are more exposed, but at the same time, I think, you know, these larger asset managers are going to take cognizance of the investment environment locally, and they will adapt for their shareholders, I'm sure. The point about, you know, financial advisors, if you want to, you know, picking larger asset managers that, you know, they take a fee. If you're not happy with your financial advisor's fee, you shouldn't pay him. Like, you should be looking at other financial advisors. It's not difficult to switch financial advisors. Unfortunately, I think the way that our market is set up is that financial advisors are very prone to investing in known asset managers. They want to invest in the, you know, the big names. Why do they want to invest in the big names? Because they get paid on assets under management. They're asset gatherers, essentially, not necessarily your advisor. What then, you know, the result of that is that, you know, if the markets collapse, they can say, oh, we've got this big pension advisor, the pension, or at least the big asset manager. The big asset manager is not under pressure then to perform and not under pressure to pull the fees down. But if you are willing to look outside those big asset managers, they are very, very good smaller asset managers that will work purely for performance. That,
like the two of you.
I'm just saying, send us some assets. We'll work for performance only.
Thanks, Gary. Moving on. Please ask the panel their view on Booking Holdings, Embraer, and whether to play cybersecurity theme through pure play Palo Alto Networks or through diversified Cisco systems. So I'm talking about extending our reach offshore. Booking Holdings, would that
be
all Booking
Holdings? Booking.com. It was Priceline. Name changed last year to Booking.com. It's not the only brand I own. They have a few. One is a table booking at restaurants service. It's better known in the US. And other one is Priceline.com, which is actually aggregator of a lot of their services. But Booking.com is by far the biggest one, by far the biggest booking aggregator, about double the size of the next size one. They've got a big market in Europe, and I think that's part of the reason why the share has been under pressure, because of the ailing European market. But global travel is increasing. You can see that in the recent orders that Boeing and GE and Airbus and all those companies got in the aeronautical space after the Paris Air Show. So global air travel is still on the rise. It's a structural story, and maybe partly due to lower structural energy prices, you know, making it cheaper to travel. Yeah. And lifestyles are changing. Instead of buying a luxury item, the newer generations, Generation Y and the millennials, they're preferring to travel. So it plays into that larger cultural theme. And we own Booking.com. I think it's a fantastically run company and not a bad price at these levels.
No. Gary, do you have any thoughts on Booking.com or Embraer? I don't know if you want to take that. Embraer, is that a defense company?
I don't follow
Embraer, E-M-B-R-A-E-R.
No, don't know them.
Don't know them.
I know the big defense companies. I don't know them.
Or the cybersecurity theme.
Cybersecurity?
Yeah, cybersecurity. Would you... Okay, so if cybersecurity is a theme that you like, would you go through Palo Alto Networks, or would you buy diversified Cisco systems?
We've held Cisco systems in the past. I think, I'd rather go through Cisco systems, but you know, if you look at the... I mean, just to kind of, you know, add on to the Booking.com theme as well, if you look at these, you know, global cybersecurity, you look at anything that is a software-based company these days, the global market, there's only really room for one or two major players. So you generally find that you will do better in the big brand names, a company like Cisco, because they will be able to dominate cybersecurity. They'll be able to dominate, I mean, Cisco is more than that. It's switches and, you know, hard infrastructure as well. But I'm a big fan of investing into, you know, I suppose the big name brands overseas that have the ability to service multiple jurisdictions, service the globe, rather than kind of niche players that you'd find on a local market.
Okay. Embraer is a Brazilian aerospace company, so I figured it had something to do, but it's the third biggest producer of civil aircraft after Boeing and Airbus, so we can maybe do a bit of homework on that. But getting to topics this evening, Dricus, this is a favorite of yours, Burford, the litigation company. You mentioned it a couple of weeks ago. Why are you still buying it?
Well, the price hasn't moved. You know, and the investment case is getting stronger at the moment. They had a big litigation case. Well, they're pretty diversified. They're the biggest litigation financier out of there. But there's a bigger one that's gone in their favor, and they sold off a lot of the risk, actually. And that should have, you could see a bump on the share price there. That happened. But there's a big sale in the market. Okay. It's called the Woodford Income Equity Trust.
Oh, this is
their biggest holding, I think, or second biggest holding by
this
far.
This is the UK company that's in trouble, right?
Exactly. So they're facing big redemptions. They opened the fund today again, but they've been selling stock all over. Okay. They own the majority, not the majority, but they're by far the biggest holder of the share, and that puts a structural cap. I think it's been putting a cap on the share price for quite a while, but I think that's a great opportunity for what is actually an incredible investment case.
Okay, so Burford, once again, a litigation company. And Gary, you
litigation
are
financier.
Litigation financier, sorry. Yeah. Gary, and you're buying Intel.
No, Intel, so I'm going chip makers just on the G20 theme. So obviously we've seen, I can't pick NVIDIA on the show again. I really believe in NVIDIA as a chip maker. And, you know, for so many reasons, just the application of the data chips in, AI technology, mobility through driverless cars, it's required. But it's not just NVIDIA that's going to do this. Intel is well placed to do this as well. You look at what's happened to the chip makers as a group. So Intel, NVIDIA, Broadcom, for example, they've all sort of traded down fairly heavily on the back of the US-China trade tensions. If we do see a subsidence, you should see significant gains in the short term on the way up. So I would be buying at these levels.
Okay. And thanks to you, gents, for helping build people's international portfolios. Gary Boyson is from Rand Swiss, Dricus Combrink is from Capicraft, and we'll be back with Stockwatch tomorrow night at 7:30. In the meantime, have a good evening. But getting to topics this evening, Dricus, this is a favorite of yours, Burford, the litigation company. Yeah. You mentioned it a couple of weeks ago. Why are you still buying it?
Well, the price hasn't moved. You know, and the investment case is getting stronger at the moment. They had a big litigation case. Well, they're pretty diversified. They're the biggest litigation financier out of there. But there's a bigger one that's gone in their favor, and they sold off a lot of the risk, actually. And that should have... you could see a bump on the share price there. That happened, but there's a big sale in the market. Okay. It's called the Woodford Income Equity Trust.
Oh, this is
their biggest holding, I think, or second biggest holding by
this
far.
This is the UK company that's in trouble, right?
Exactly. So they're facing big redemptions. They've opened the fund today again, but they've been selling stock all over. Okay. They own the majority, not the majority, but they're by far the biggest holder of the share, and that puts a structural cap. I think it's been putting a cap on the share price for quite a while, but I think that's a great opportunity for what is actually an incredible investment case.
Okay, so Burford, once again, a litigation company. And Gary, you
litigation
are...
Litigation financier.
Litigation financier, sorry. Yeah. Gary, and you're buying Intel.
No, Intel, so I'm going chip makers just on the G20 theme. So obviously we've seen, I can't pick NVIDIA on the show again. I really believe in NVIDIA as a chip maker. And, for so many reasons, just the application of the data chips in, AI technology, mobility through driverless cars, it's required. But it's not just NVIDIA that's going to do this. Intel is well placed to do this as well. You look at what's happened to the chip makers as a group. So Intel, NVIDIA, Broadcom, for example, they've all sort of traded down fairly heavily on the back of the US-China trade tensions. If we do see a subsidence, you should see significant gains in the short term on the way up. So I would be buying at these levels.
Okay. And thanks to you, gents, for helping build people's international portfolios. Gary Boyson is from Rand Swiss. Dricus Combrink is from Capicraft. And we'll be back with Stockwatch tomorrow night at 7:30. In the meantime, have a good evening.